And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
This is the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast with your hosts, Michael Campbell and Greg Howell.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Adventist Pilgrimage Podcast. The episode we've been working on here today has kind of just been coming together based on some new experiences and some new discoveries. We wanted to just kind of share a few of those things with you. Part of history and history making, from the historian's perspective anyway, is spending a lot of time in the archives. Archives are probably not necessarily what you would think. I mean, usually when I'm thinking about archives, what comes to mind is some deep old cavernous place and a huge library with wood paneling and all. Like, we would think it's nice and cool like that, but ultimately it's a little bit less. Much of the time is actually just spent at a table, and people have old folders they bring to you, or maybe you're looking through file cabinets and different things like that. This week, Michael's had a chance to dig around in the General Conference archives back in Maryland and has found a couple of cool things. Michael, tell us a little bit about your experience, what it's like to be in archives, and maybe, hey, some of the new stuff that you found.
Yeah, Greg, great to talk together and be able to share with some of our listeners. You know, part of doing archival research, it feels a bit like Indiana Jones. I know there's a new movie coming out, and so if you like sleuthing and that little bit of historical sense of discovery, and there aren't any magical moments where you find some magic box or anything like that. Most of archival research, Greg, what you were just talking about, is pretty perfunctory or ordinary. It's just bringing out a box of stuff, of letters and different files, and just one folder at a time. And so I was really excited, Greg, because, it's easy to get very busy with all the work that you do. And even though I'm in the role of an archivist and historian at the North American Division, just down the road from us is the General Conference Archives, thanks to David Trim and Ashley Chisholm and their staff. And so this last week I had an afternoon, and then another day I had a morning. So I had kind of basically about a day to go through a couple of archival boxes of an ongoing research project. One of the things I've been doing is doing work on Warren Eugene Howell, who is the director of the Seventh-day Adventist Church's education department from about 1918 to 1930. And so I've done a lot of research. I've read all of his published articles. I've written an encyclopedia article about him. And of course, he was a very active participant in the 1919 Bible Conference. So this gave me a chance to go through, Greg, and talk and look in his correspondence files a little bit more closely and to see what I could find there.
Yeah, and as far as I know, no relation as on my end of things. I do not think that I...
No relation to you, Greg, huh? You don't have any special...
Not that I know of. I
mean, diaries or anything, huh?
It would that I did. I that would be amazing, but I do not think so.
If only. Well... we do know that Warren Howell, he did have a daughter named Felicia, and she was actually an artist in the Hudson River School of Art. Her art now goes for thousands of dollars at auctions.
Wow.
But she married, check this out, the grandson of John Deere, Factory, the tractors. Yeah. And so... So he was fabulously wealthy, of course. As you can only imagine. And so she married him and would travel around on yachts and go to vacations
and
in
tractors.
Europe, lived an incredible lifestyle. Yeah, the tractor dude. I think sure her connections to Adventism were a little bit tenuous there at the end. It's kind of a sad story, I guess you might say, but she didn't have any children, so there weren't any direct descendants of. I've actually checked this out.
Well, it's because those,
and although I'd love to have one of her paintings,
it's because those are the people that we would still be able to talk to that might have stuff, right?
Exactly, and that is what we're looking for. Some years ago, there was a bunch of Warren Eugene Howell stuff, books that had his book plate and stuff like that someone was selling on eBay. And so I know part of his collection. I have no idea how the provenance, but I know some of it ended up with at least one person up in Canada. And I've actually managed to pick up a couple things that have his signature in them that have turned up over the years, too. In fact, a few things from the General Conference archives. I remember Bert Holowiak, who just passed away. When I went to my very first trip to the General Conference archives, he had a stack of stuff. So these are duplicates I'm getting rid of. And one of them was just an old yearbook, an extra copy, but it had Howell's signature there on it. So he said, hey, would you like this? And of course, you can just imagine as a teenager, excited about Adventist history, what you would have said too, right? So anyways, but Howell, so he's the person I'm interested in. And so I started by looking at his boxes, which were mostly in the Secretariat files. Now, I have a little bit of a confession, and that is when I was doing my dissertation, my work on the 1919 Bible Conference, I came out, I didn't have a lot of money, of course, being a grad student, and so I came out and spent some time, but I mostly spent my time looking in the presidential files, and there was material on the 1919 Bible Conference, and even Howell and others. I wasn't aware that there were more files and folders related to Howell and the 1919 Bible Conference in the Secretariat correspondence files. And that's what I've been spending time in this past week, was kind of starting going through that.
Yeah.
And my goal, obviously, is to I'm trying to do a deep dive on Howell. And in the process, found some new stuff on the 1919 Bible Conference. Now, I've been looking for stuff for a long time.
Right.
Greg.
Yeah.
It's some new stuff. Just shows
help,
up.
Help the people out, though. What's the difference between the presidential files and the Secretariat file? Like, who is the Secretariat? To me, that's like a horse that won the Kentucky Derby somewhere.
Right. Yeah. No, it's different record groups, right? And so part of finding stuff is just knowing where to look. And, you know, you can ask an archivist, you can do searches in their databases, but it doesn't mean that necessarily always stuff will pop up when you're looking for it. But because sometimes you'll have folders, and unless there's enough letters in a particular by a particular person or that's in their database, you're not going to know. So presidential would have been within the denomination. You've got the presidential, the General Conference president, you have the executive secretary of the organization. Mm-hmm. So that's the Secretariat files. You have treasury, and those are usually your three departments that of any organization, whether a conference, union, division, or the general conference. And so it was interesting. This was just a different record group. I had no idea. And, you know, of course, he was just one of many people at the 1919 Bible Conference. But what I learned was he was actually the secretary of the planning committee for the 1919 Bible Conference. And since I found these folders in this different record group, I had no idea they were there or how significant they were. Found some of the folders or different documents pertaining to the actual planning of the 1919 Bible Conference. Now, I don't think there's anything that really changes any fundamental things. It's just more a little nuance, more detail. For example, who were the actual members of the planning committee for the 1919 Bible Conference? We kind of knew who some of them were, but actually to have the voted action where here's the five people. A.G. Daniels, of course, was the chair of that group. Howell was the secretary. So you have just a little bit more detail. And I found in 1918, a year ahead of time, where here's all the possible topics we might look at. Now, I've seen later versions of that, but this is the earliest list of topics and a list of the different people. And I did not know this, but there was one voted exception for someone to participate in the 1919 Bible Conference. So it was invitation only. And I basically said, well, it's invitation only unless there was a voted exception.
You got me worried.
Well, there was one voted
this
exception.
This isn't a Jesuit, right? Come on.
No, it wasn't Greg Howell either.
Well, you know, I didn't come with my real name.
Oh, man, I knew there was something up, something fishy here. So, but yeah, it's fun when you find just a little bit more of that nuance, that detail. Here's a couple of these voted actions. And the great thing is I would have totally included this in my dissertation had I been aware of it. And this comes to, you know, you only know as much as you can find.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if you can find it and dig in the archives, it just becomes that much more more significant and detailed. And it's the fun part of research is just finding who those people are. By the way, here's the actual voted action, May 18, 1919. It's a letter by looks like W.A. Spicer, no, J.L. Shaw, excuse me, J.L. Shaw to W.E. Howell. And he says, of course, Daniels was the chair of the committee. He was the secretary. That is W.E. Howell, J.L. Shaw, and then E.R. Palmer. J.L. Shaw would have been the secretary of, I'm trying to remember, secretary or treasurer, but he was a very influential person at the General Conference during the 19 teens and 20s. So J.L. Shaw, E.R. Palmer, who is long-standing person in the publishing, the Review and Herald, and George B. Thompson. So these are kind of the heavyweights, probably some of the most influential church leaders. So it's really not a surprise that they would be the ones that would be the key people in planning the 1919 Bible Conference. That's kind of fun.
Nice.
And then you have some additional voted actions. Here's the people that, here's the topics that they want. And then a letter of invitation. I'd seen that before, but just a few of these very small details, but definitely very enriching. And it just shows, hey, I've been working on this, Greg, for a long
I was going to
time.
say, yeah.
And to be able to find something new I hadn't seen before, for me, I had to do a little happy dance. Just it's that exciting when you find some new
There's
material.
more stuff out there. And I think that highlights that you're never really done. You just choose when to stop. Like there's more places to dig, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and sometimes you find things in unexpected places where you didn't anticipate that you would necessarily find something, but there it is. There it is hiding in plain sight
Right,
sometimes.
right.
And by the way, one of the really cool things that I did not expect is reading through all of Howell's letters and different things in there. This week was how controversial M.E. Olson, that's Olson with an E at the end, M.E. Olson, Malin E. O. Olson, one of our earliest Adventist historians, he wrote the first denominational textbook.
Huh.
You know, there's some significant unhappiness with Olson's manuscript. And part of the reason we know this is that Howell writes a letter to Spicer and says, "Hey, there's this other person working on this manuscript, so we have to be very discreet about this." But basically, that would you write this denominational textbook? We all kind of feel that you would do a you know do hit the mark in terms of what they're looking for.
This is before poor old Olson even knows.
Yeah, Olson doesn't know, and the next thing he knows is that he's taking
Painful.
the summer off. He's an academic. He's teaching at Union College. And so then he's requesting that he get a paycheck from the GC for the summer because he's working on this project. So now they're kind of betwixt and between. They've got him starting to work on a manuscript. They actually also have kind of commissioned Spicer to work on this. Spicer is very diplomatic, and what he does is his passion is missions. So he writes a survey of missions and the work of the church and various missionaries and missions around the world church. And what ends up happening is they basically end up having two books that come out of this. They have Olson's history, and it seems to be that from reading between the lines and the comments that are made that the people that are complaining about his manuscript, it's too dense, it's too just factual. Here's all the facts, here's the history, and they want something that is a little bit more spiritual. There's definitely this intimation they want something more spiritually, more spiritual kind of narrative. And so they see his
It's a
is
textbook.
too formal, too academic, and so Spicer, they're hoping will be more inspirational. And so what ends up happening is they end up getting both. They get Olson and his manuscript, his textbook, and they get Spicer. And in the end, after all this correspondence back and forth, they basically say, well, they'll use both of them for when our teachers teach denominational history. And so
Huh.
both are meant to be used together. And so that's very interesting to me. And so, in fact, at one
Yeah.
point, they tell Olson, stop in 1901. Don't go past 1901. at the reorganization of the church. That's as far as you go. And then we want to have different departments of the church, like the education and treasury and everything else. We'll have them write some brief narratives of their department. If you look at Olson's textbook, his narrative, his origin of Seventh-day Adventists, it basically, if you look at the end, there's a series of chapters, like the last 10, 12 chapters are all these small little chapters that are focused on various departments of the church. And if my reading of this correspondence is right, Olson never actually wrote those. Those were written by various people at church headquarters that kind of added to whatever Olson had written in his manuscript. So that's kind of interesting too.
Yeah, because that's fascinating. I bump into this periodically whenever I start writing history that's a little too recent, right? Mm-hmm. You know, people that are still around and are alive, and now you're writing about them, like, they don't like that so much. That's where things get fuzzy. It's easier to write history about people who can't argue back with you anymore. So, I mean,
it's true.
Not terribly surprising, really. 1901, that's an easy cutoff, because now everybody that you're talking about is alive, and maybe you won't say it right. Like, that's a fascinating little insight on that.
Yeah. So there's all this drama back and forth about the very first denominational textbook. And so I know there's been a lot of talk about denominational historiography and everything else, and talked about later textbooks like Richard Schwartz and Lightbearers and everything else. But I don't think anyone's really paid really close attention to the first, what was considered the first denominational textbook. Of course, before that, there's Loughborough, who writes his kind of his history. It's kind of a storytelling that he does, as a kind of a spiritual storytelling. But by the early 1920s, there's a new generation. By the way, one other little detail is Albertsworth, E.F. Albertsworth. I write it in my 1922 book, how he kind of gets in trouble and he eventually loses his job. What I found is before the 1919 Bible Conference, there is some concerns that the teachers at Washington Missionary College are suspect, that they're too liberal. And it's not just Albertsworth. There's Sorensen, C.M. Sorensen, and H. Camden Lacey. And all three of them, at one point, there's a small committee, a small group that includes Howell, that sit down with them, interview them, basically warn them and say, hey, you guys need to kind of shape up and pay a little bit more careful attention about how you're teaching and not casting doubts into the minds of students, that and sufficiently that the conversations were sufficient to assure Howell that none of the three of them were actually doing that. So they were able to present that back to the board. You should go ahead and rehire them. But it does set a little bit more of the context that those three specific professors at Washington Missionary College, that they are kind of under careful watch list scrutiny. Yeah, you might say that. And so, of course, you know, all of them are very progressive in terms of not pushing for a rigid and errant view of, or fundamentalist view of, Ellen White, if you please. And that's definitely part of the context.
Do you feel like that's just another, you know, early stage view of the fundamentalist modernist debates that's kind of already creeping in, even in these later 1910s?
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt about it. You know, that there's this wider context going on. Of course, they're at Washington Missionary College. Another interesting little detail is I was finalizing up, I'd done a lot of this work a long time ago, maybe a year ago, on Jane Anderson, a First Adventist official missionary with his wife and sister-in-law to China. And by 1919, he's teaching, he teaches at Washington Missionary College. He's also teaching at Union College. He goes back and forth. But I think he's actually at Union when he goes to the 1919 Bible Conference. He's one of those that's also very progressive in terms of avoiding a rigid, narrow view of Ellen White, and that we need to educate the church. He goes back and he keeps teaching. He supports the church, but at the same time is not afraid of addressing these kinds of issues and the need to educate young people about those issues. And he's going on through the 20s and 30s. And finally, by 39, he gives some presentations about Ellen White that cause enough concern that when he gets back to Union College, they actually basically fire him. And we were able to get a little bit of that detail. Now, this wasn't in the GC archives. This was thanks to some oral histories, some memory statements that people had left by Everett Dick and several others later. But I was able to actually include that in my new article, again, thanks to some new materials, new research that I was able to become familiar with just in the last few weeks. And anyways, you know, it's just part of that process where you just constantly find new things. One more thing that I just found really cool is, some of you know, I've done some work on Margaret Rowan, written an encyclopedia article. And sometimes you're looking in those file folders in Howell and you find another folder that's really close to it. And in this case, there was a folder by S.N. Haskell, again, very prominent early Adventist minister. And as I was going through, I thought, oh, I'll just take a quick glance at this, and found a couple of letters related to Haskell and Margaret Rowan. Now, Margaret Rowan is the person who claims to be Ellen White's prophetic successor. So Haskell writes a letter to T.E. Bowen.
We've talked about her on the podcast.
We've talked about her before, too. Writes this letter to T.E. Bowen, who's one of the church leaders back at church headquarters and secretariat, we call it today. And kind of is giving a little bit of that story. And I'm just going to read this paragraph just because I think it's so fun. Haskell writing to Bowen. Here's this letter. It's dated September 23, 1920. He writes this: "The only thing about Mrs. Rowan's work, to my mind, is that there is enough to the woman to be used by the devil to accomplish what she did. I have seen her and talked with her, and she appeared as quite an unoffensive person. The first copy she sent out," that's talking about her copy of her visions, right? Her pamphlet where she's sharing, right? And I go back to quoting Haskell, "I understand, was sent to me with a request that I reply to it in a way that could be used." In other words, she's trying to get Haskell to endorse her as one of Ellen White's strongest supporters, right? So she's trying hard here. And he goes on, says, "I simply ran through it and said I would have to reconstruct nearly all of my theology to accept it, because it denied Bible facts and it denied Sister White's writings." So there you go. Just this little bit of color, a little bit of fun, as here these church leaders are kind of talking, hey, you know,
candid moment. Yeah.
And I'd have to reconstruct all my theology in order to accept what she's teaching. So just fun little anecdotes.
It's interesting to hear how this is being received, because so much of our history, you know, it is biographical. And if you look up the article on Margaret Rowan, biographical, we've got these extra details. But then you hear how she's being received, or how she's impressing or not impressing other people. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of color that kind of fleshes out these extra narratives. I know you've got some other stuff that does that. Every time, like,
as you look in, you see that color everywhere. You see that color in almost every page, Greg. And one of the things that you definitely, just one little incidental thing before we wrap up here, and that is a missionary from Africa. He'd come back, and he basically, kind of a runaway missionary, you might say. I guess he wasn't very well appreciated or received, and so he comes back.
He got some colorful background to him. Let people know what the letter is.
Yeah, and so they're kind of telling a story. Hey, watch out for this guy. You know, kind of here's what's going on. But apparently his wife got very ill. I think she had tuberculosis or something. And so he kind of just dumps his wife. And so she's trying to survive, gets enough money, goes and finds a claim up in Wyoming to look for gold, finds enough money from that she's able to stake out a claim. And so she's just eking out a living, and you can see how these church leaders are just really, they feel really sorry for her. And they're talking about her husband, who should have been a little bit more considerate and taking care of her. And at one point they call him a scoundrel. So the runaway missionary scoundrel.
This is abandonment, man.
Yeah, that's pretty strong language for 100 years ago, I think. So you can just see how badly they feel for how this situation has unfolded. And in the meantime, they're still looking for more missionaries. And of course, a lot of times it works out, and sometimes it's amazing, but every once in a while there's where it didn't work out really so well. And so you see these letters back and forth. This one particular missionary And they're writing like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this is really terrible. I'm using my own words now, but yeah, definitely. Here's this scoundrel, runaway missionary.
Yeah, this to me, honestly, is what makes history interesting, mm-hmm. because it shows you a character and a person, mm-hmm. but it shows them in various situations that don't get recorded in the normal history book, right?
Absolutely.
Without digging in these archives, without you going down and spending a morning and an afternoon opening up the random folders that, you know, maybe nobody's looked in for the last 50 years,
yep.
we wouldn't know any of that stuff.
Absolutely. And it's just one page at a time, taking careful notes. And then, of course, for me, what I like to use, I use Evernote, just write a little note card for every letter or two and just kind of summarize what were the key points. And as I continue doing my research, I can incorporate hopefully that richness, that detail. And the more you do that is you just carefully take the time. You can't scan it. A lot of it's handwritten or it's very faint, but you know, you just have to, you know, very carefully, and that richness, that nuance comes out all the more over time as you keep digging.
Yeah. Yeah. Now this is fascinating stuff, Michael. And I think that as we get more into some of these kind of extra details and these larger pictures, we're weaving together a sense of continuity in the church, at least humanity per se, mm-hmm. That these people are not just the old names listed in the yearbook. You know, like I had somebody point out last week, why do they always have the first two initials of people's names? And that's how we only, like, we wouldn't know these people as more than just the weird two initials, A.G. Daniels, W.E. Howell. Now you're getting a voice. You're giving a little bit of the humanity back to them by finding this stuff. I think that's really cool. And I think it makes our church richer. And it makes it feel like they're not that different than us, right?
Yeah. And the quest isn't over, you know. I suspect another, you know, a few years or 10 years or until the Lord comes, you know, and I find some folder or box somewhere else and might have some diaries or letters that just shed all the more insight and richness to anything from the 1919 Bible Conference to many other facets of our Adventist past.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I we're always looking for diaries. I actually, even in my eBay search engine, every time a Millerite and the word diary shows up in some random eBay thing, it'll notify. Like, we're just looking for that stuff, right? It's always hoping that somebody else will find it and put it up somewhere. Well, Michael, thank you for digging. Thank you for finding and for adding some nuance here. I think as we're headed into the Christmas holidays, lots of people are hanging out and seeing things. If you're going home, if you are headed back and you know that there's some old connections in your family to the Adventist world and the Adventist history, poke around, ask grandma and grandpa, do some interviews. I know as people, we're not just officially historians. We're all historians, right? We all have family. We all have connection. See what's out there. And if you do find something cool, please let us hear at either the Adventist History Podcast or the Pilgrimage yeah. Podcast. Let us know.
Let us know.
We would love please. To hear about this stuff.
It, by the way, just along those lines, I gave a worship this last week at the North American Division. It was just some early mission stories on John Fulton. And one of my colleagues came along and said, hey, I'm the great-granddaughter of John Fulton. And I'm like, what? And yeah. She said, yeah, I'm going home for Christmas and my mom. And let's, you know, I said, hey, see if there's any pictures or diaries or anything, you know. And she said, I'm going to check. I'm going to see if there's anything left in the family that people might have, you know, even just, I don't need the originals, but if someone has a diary or a letter, just even to get a snapshot, a photo of that, it both helps preserve and helps people like you and me, Greg, that are historians, like, hey, that gives us that little snapshot, literally, by finding new sources like that. And we want to make sure to do our best to support people to preserve those things so that those stories can be better told.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, hey, thanks again. If you've been listening for a while, we want to thank you for that. I think this is actually episode 20, maybe even 21. I'm not sure how far we've gotten in these. But either way, if you were a longtime listener, thank you for showing up and for being that kind of a person. We like you. You are awesome. Otherwise, have a great holiday, folks, and keep looking, keep reading, keep discovering stuff about our Adventist heritage.
And Jesus himself said that he did not come to do away with the law.
He does not take us out of this world if he does not want us to be contaminated by it.